All right, welcome back. We're going to start with our discussion of these three presentations. And first thing I wanted to say, Ron and I were sitting next to each other doing a bit of tweeting as the session went on. There seem to be several different hashtags going. There's one hashtag Anthropocene, another one Anthropocene Campus, all one word, and some people Anthropocene, hashtag Anthropocene space campus. So perhaps converge on Anthropocene, it's shorter. I'll just open the discussion by asking one question for everyone. And that's this. I want to return to the question of scale, which is everywhere in these discussions. And I want to do it specifically through the ideas about deep time. So Bron mentioned this, Jürgen and Manfred mentioned it too. Sabina and Johan really didn't talk about it specifically, but you did have a kind of this the graph of the recent dramatic change in the sort of utilization of ecosystems by people and damage to them. So the question is, how do we value deep time? What role does it play in these discussions, except as an analogy or a thought experiment or a kind of way of reflecting on how we got to where we are? If the pace of change is so rapid now, what relevance does it have for our discussions of the Anthropocene?
I think this is a very, very, very good question, and it may seem to be kind of a luxury to even reflect about deep time. But as far as I understand the biological side, and I'm relying here, of course, on my biological colleagues, the biological metaphor by which we might capture the significance of deep time is that of canalization. It shapes our options. This was Manfred's example of the body plan. Which options we have in a given situation very much depends on choices that may have been made very deeply in time. And to illustrate it, you know, again, the Neolithic revolution is, I think, an excellent example, because the species with which we are dealing with, in spite of Manfred's provocative remark on biodiversity, are still the species that had been domesticated. I mean, these form the basis of the species that we are utilizing in current days. So they have been produced in that time. But it doesn't just extend to the biological dimension. If you think, for instance, on how people build houses, you know, and by the way, Jan Zalazievich for our seminar made that proposal, you know, take an object and try to do the techno-stratigraphy on it. I think without Jan's competence, we won't be able to really do that. But take apart an object like a house. You know, he was thinking about this building, for instance, as an example, and look where its components are coming from. And it turns out that, you know, all matter eventually comes from the stars, so to say, but that's not what I mean. Some of the basic ideas, for instance, on how we build houses, have also deep time histories. For instance, the use of bricks. The use of bricks were closely connected to the building of straight walls and right angle buildings. These are products of the Neolithic that have canalized our evolution since then. And it's good, and this is why it is so significant, as Bron has done, to look at other cultures that haven't undergone the same kind of canalizations as we do. So we are not just comparing two current cultures, we are comparing two different evolutionary pathways that reach deeply back in time. And if we want to understand it, we cannot just confront the present-day situations. We have to understand these long chains of causality.
So if you combine scale and time with the other concept that's a major one for the whole campus, and that's complexity, then you can observe a few interesting phenomena and pose a few questions. So one would be an open question whether if you're dealing with complex systems at different scales, are they actually governed by isomorphic principles? It's an open question. There's some evidence in some cases they are. In other cases, we have unique features. But that's certainly something that we need to consider when we talk about the complexities of the Anthropocene. Another phenomena of that historical approach that we had in the deep time framework, but that works also on different scales, is, as Jürgen pointed out, is that phenomenon of canalization. But canalization has sort of a twin problem, and that's the unintended consequences part. And one of the questions that you can ask is the higher the complexity of a system and you perform any kind of intervention, do you see what's the kind of increase in unintended consequences that the system generates? There are some physicist colleagues of mine at the Santa Fe Institute that try to capture those ideas in form of scaling or power laws. And if that indeed is true, then we have a big problem, because the more complex our society becomes, the more any kind of intervention will have an exponential increase in unintended consequences. So if even some of those patterns hold remotely, then the question is, how can we actually change or intervene in the current complexities of the Anthropocene at all? So those are some, I think, questions and focused research areas that you get out of that deep time perspective.
Well, I could add it's more like a comment, but it tries to put some of the bits and pieces together. As biologists working in particular in evolution and development, what we call evo-devo, we are familiar with the idea that everything is historically informed. When you go from the egg to the adult, you always get the memory of the mother tissues or context. Now, what is interesting is we see this as a sequence, but probably the time scale as a linear configuration is probably putting us into a wrong context. Take Neolithic revolution. Also, technosphere seems to have taken us out of the Neolithic time. I am almost sure that nobody in this room, including myself, escaped Neolithic configuration and cosmological remnants of our ancestors. Concerning religion, if agriculture, human being settled by agriculture, if we follow the hypothesis of Covin, it seems that there was first religious reform, and then farming came with it, not apparently the lack of food or whatever. So we are sitting in a puzzle in which each of us contain a bit of Neolithic revolution, a bit of technosphere revolution, and a bit of the coming slow Anthropocene, I hope.
I'll just add one thing to that really interesting exchange, which is another way of rendering the deep of deep time, which is kind of down, you know, the way that the, and obviously geologists make us think that way, that, you know, going down is going back in time. There are interesting things we can do with that in terms of thinking about how past age, well, so the first point is that much of the discourse of the Anthropocene is very much in the critical zone, the sort of thin layer of life on the top of the earth, and there's not enough remembering of the deep layers of the earth and how much they still configure and condition our being. And, you know, there's a sense in which even the earliest eon, for example, of the Earth, you know, the Hadean eon, where there was no life because it was all so hot and volatile, is somehow still part of the Earth's being. You know, it's still part of what drives the, you know, a lot of processes on the surface through tectonics and so on. So, I think deep time is also a way of thinking about the depth of the earth and how much, you know, fossil fuels are you know, yes, the burning of fossil fuels is an Anthropocene phenomenon, but it's completely conditioned by earlier periods, and in a way, it's a kind of reviving of some of the vitality of an earlier period. So I think deep time is also a way of reminding ourselves of the depths of the earth and how those are still conditioning the present.
I'm a historian, but I feel I'm not so much inspired by the deep time, but by time. And here I agree with Manfred, who said history matters, and it's temporality perhaps that is something to discuss, not spatiality only, but temporality. And if you have to, should we extend that to deep time? I don't know, but I found that was very convincing, the case that you made here about putting the present situation in relation to other times and other possible times and spaces. Isn't that what it's about? Because very often it seems to be a very present time endeavor that we're in and congregating here for something that spans perhaps the past 50, 60 years, but to look beyond both to the past and possible futures is what makes this interesting, I find, and also really to situate oneself in a much longer time frames, but also then spatial scales. Which I think was much more what Johan and I were trying to do with the city scales, regional scales, global scales, all these kind of spatialities involved that are not really coherent. It's very difficult to make these translations and to encompass really everyone inhabiting these spaces. And in a similar way, it's complicated to encompass everyone inhabiting these different times, it feels, and then you have these time-space geographies here emerging that are, I think, really, really interesting to look at, and much more than I've done so far. I think that's really a challenge, an opportunity to.
Let's move to questions from the audience. I can't see very well up here. Take these off. Anyone? Do we have one over here? Do we have a microphone? Okay, let's go to the. We have one back there first, and you're getting a mic. Hold it. Oh, okay. Let's go ahead. It'll come on.
Okay, my question is related to the technosphere co-evolution thing. I teach a course in political geography of the Anthropocene. And in fact, that begins with the reading of Zeta and Smith. And it relates to also the circumscription theory of state formation. So what I find is that the political organization also evolves as first to with the niche, and as the niche becomes too small, and then we have a periodical evolution of the political organization. So I was wondering if there's examples of social species evolving their social structures based on circumscription or...
Yes.
May I first say that this is a wonderful question. It's the right person to answer this.
The most fascinating one are the ants. In that context. So without getting into the biological details too deeply, but you see, if you just start comparing, let's say, organizational scales, what you can see is that you have species of ants, we call them generally more primitive, even though that's problematic, that have a social organization that is mainly governed by, let's call it a dominance hierarchy, and they are limited in size. What you then see is that caste differentiation and division of labor begins to emerge, and it is regulated through a complex network that involves various forms of social and ecological niches in the nest. And the finals, then you get another transition where caste determination and division of labor is basically genetically determined, and you have, because of that, an increase again in the size of those colonies. And what we observed more recently in the case of those super colonies, as they are called, like one colony spanning, you know, half of the coastline of the Mediterranean, where the conflict within those various nests of the colony are eliminated, and you have now one colony that has multiple queens, completely non-centralized control, and it works very nicely. So if you look at this as an analogy to the kind of institutional changes that we see in political organization, then you can ask yourself, can we learn something about the organizational principles of those kind of institutions? And this is what our framework here of combining regulatory evolution with niche construction is trying to accomplish. So it's an excellent question, and I think we can point to many areas of fruitful interactions along those lines.
Looks like the human species has lost his political pheromones. We kept just the sexual ones.
Well, you're just not that evolved in the ants, you know.
Take another back there.
Is this working? I have a question about knowledge, and I guess, everyone might address this, but I think Bron in particular. So it seems like when we think of knowledge, there's a very available way of thinking about it, which is from the first person. So when we speak of knowledge, there's a knower, and we can identify with the knower because, you know, we all have that experience of knowing, and it's a very individualized kind of process, I guess. But certainly challenge of interdisciplinarity seems to bring up the idea of a kind of decentering of knowledge, that the individual knower just doesn't have the bandwidth, so to speak, to do all the processing that's required. I mean, other than a couple people on the panel, or some of the organizers of the seminar might be able to do that. But for most of us, that's just not we're just not possible. Or that's just not possible for us to do. So I wonder, does this take us into the idea of a kind of necessity of embedding the kind of knowledge that we're that's required to address the Anthropocene, both from a just kind of purely speculative point of view, but even more importantly from a practical point of view? Does this mean that this is really a very fundamental epistemic kind of challenge, because we're talking about a model of knowing that's really beyond anything that we can personally experience? It's just not something any one person can put inside his or her own head any longer. So I wonder what people think about that.
I would like to volunteer to make a first order answer to that. And I think your intuition is of course right that there are some fundamental epistemic or epistemological changes that we are facing. However, the way that you asked the question, I would say this is a very old phenomenon. I mean, it's at least as old as early human cooperative societies, where division of labor takes place and where not every individual had the same perspective as every other individual. And knowledge was shared, knowledge was a social phenomenon from those early periods. And certainly when you had institutionalized, materially based, symbolically based transmission of knowledge, where in early societies you had the necessity, even in early urban societies, there were, for the intellectuals that were running the administration, long periods of apprenticeship, where they had to appropriate the collective knowledge available, and they did so in diverse ways, not everybody learning the same thing from this shared knowledge resource. So I think this distributivity, both of knowledge and thinking, is a very old human phenomenon. That doesn't exclude that there are new things that are happening now. But I think the way that you phrase this, it's a deep time phenomenon, at least on the human scale.
Yeah, it's a really great question. And I was just, maybe think of the ant story that Mumford told as well. There's some lessons there about how to organize more complexity by internal differentiation and division of labor. But I mean, there are the
It is so complex because, yes, I understand exactly why I use the word embedding, you know, that in some sense it has to be distributed, you know, it can't just be held within one mind or whatever. But in a way, that's already happened in the history of science, isn't it? You know, if you think of, you know, I'm thinking of the work of Lorraine Daston and Peter Galison on the sort of evolution of the idea of objectivity in the sciences and the way that, you know, in the days of the sort of Newton and Boyle, you know, where Newton used to stick a knitting needle behind his eyeball and press it, and, you know, so he was the observer, that, you know, and Boyle was the great, you know, describer of what happened in his experiments, you know, and he would never have left it to some lowly minion, you know, to describe, to take down the readings of the experiment. And then, you know, by the end of the 19th century, you know, this very sort of depersonalized, bland, sort of a perspectival new view from nowhere style of academic writing had emerged because of the internationalization of science and the way that science had to convince people who, you know, who they had never met, you know, through this particular kind of objectivist language and the use of you know, semi-skilled, you know, laboratory labor, you know, standardizing, et cetera, et cetera, all that kind of thing, and we're all inheriting it. And I mean, you know, Paul knows this much better than I do in terms of how it's evolved in the 20th century, but the danger there is, of course, what's lost. You know, this is what Daston says, you know, that you can have this sort of objectivist language, which is all very view from nowhere, but is it actually describing the phenomenon, you know? And similarly, you know, when we get all these distribution and this division of labor, you know, what kind of elisions are happening when these knowledges are being put together, you know? And Chung-Ling Kwa's work on the International Geosphere Biosphere Program is very good at sort of unpacking actually what does happen when these distributed knowledges come together, and things which become, you know, invisible kind of elisions and so on. So I think it's all terribly difficult, actually, and I don't think there's one answer. I think we need, you know, we need levels of reflexivity, both in terms of, you know, distributing knowledge and bringing it together, but also being very sensitive about how these knowledges are being brought together, and also, in the spirit of what I was saying before, trying to keep spirits of agonism, not antagonism, but a kind of the spirit of constructive clashes between knowledge, you know, which is so difficult in the pressure of a funded research project when they want, you know, clear outcomes and things, when you actually realize sometimes you have to, you know, stay with the trouble, as Haraway calls it, and actually find out where the knowledges don't fit together and use that to kind of, you know, really push thinking. So I think it's a really difficult question.
Two quick remarks, rather to provoke everybody here. So there's an interesting problem. I'm speaking from the biomedical science side, that you might have followed that. There was last year in The Economist, that unfortunate story that most experiments in biomedicine are never replicated, and if they are replicated, they generally don't work. So what does that tell us about the state of our experimental knowledge? One question. The other one is, of course, that we are facing with an increasing deluge of data, and we are seeing new patterns, even called data science, emerging and trying to generate knowledge out of those huge data sets. And what's going on there is epistemologically very interesting and not at all really reflected upon. So that's another important challenge that certainly connects to everything that we talk about the Anthropocene here. And the other question is, as a consequence of those data, we are basically trying to generate knowledge without the traditional form of being hypothesis-driven, rather data-driven. And what does that mean? So there are a lot of open questions here.
I have three people who have questions here. Let me ask everyone who speaks now to, I should have done this before, but please say your name and your institution or whatever you want to say about where you are in the world. And you need not restrict yourselves to questions. Comments are welcome too. So we'll take you first.
My name is Stella Vesiana. I work for the Federation of German Scientists. I'm also an artist researcher. And I was very inspired by the case of, I don't know if you'll pronounce the name, Mr. Sosiski. And it raised for me the issue of how do we cross discourses? Because we have the Anthropocene discourse, and how do we cross it, like with the neo-extractivism, for instance, that is the other side of, for instance, the discourse of the degrowth. So if we think that for a new economy, of a new way of living, or how we want to live, we need to reduce ourselves, or we need to rethink the way we use raw materials, resources, what does it mean if we do not consume so much, and then in Latin America, for instance, they would not need to produce so much oil. But on the same time, neo-extractivism means a new redistribution of wealth for solving problems of poverty, for instance. So for me, one question would be this crossing of discourses. How do we do this in relation to the Anthropocene? And another question would be, how do we include other kinds of knowledge system that you talked about that are embedded in different life and disciplinary worlds in the curricula of the Anthropocene campus without assimilating it, just making it part of it, but how do we let them be? And I think you already addressed this issue, but I think it's really important. And the other question would be, how do we transfer this to the political system in terms of governance? For instance, the WGBU, that is the German Council for Climate and Environmental Issues, has based his whole report 2011 on the term of the Anthropocene, even not being already a natural science confirmed term. But they already are, it's a term that's already introduced in the political system, giving advice to the German government. And they proposed a global governance, global social governance contract. But there are serious concerns from other parts of the world how this global system should look like. Will it be, again, a Western dominated way of thinking? Is the Anthropocene coming from the natural sciences, again, a Western thought, being pushed over other kinds of thought systems? How can they be in a plural, deliberative, democratic system? How can they be integrated? And how can they be integrated? Also, I like very much your comment about the commons. How do we want to embed this? So this maybe 3 points, cross discourses, cross curricula, and governance.
Okay, let's do that right now.
Solve that one.
But great question, I find. And I was, of course, asking myself the same thing while listening this morning. And the first thing that comes to mind, of course, is that, as we heard yesterday, Anthropocene discourse is not anything closed and fixed and all set. So my feeling never was that it's already sort of separate or somehow exclusive. And is not in conversation with everything else that has been going on for a long time, the degrowth movements and the sustainability initiatives and the NGOs and so on that are working in similar fields. So I thought the idea was to bring together people that are not just the academic crowd and community that is always talking to each other anyway, but to raise this issue in the first place as something that is much more open and in that sense much more experimental and uncertain about where it will lead us to than any conventional discourse that is in place and delimited. And somehow stabilized. So I don't see that yet. So I see less problems in this area. Much more difficult, I find, also is how to include like diverse local knowledges into something that is a curriculum that still claims to be to hold. What we do here will have some effect on that discourse, on Anthropocene talking and practicing, and how can we actually do that if it's basically secondhand, it's handed down reports that we get from other places? How do we integrate that? What do we do with it? Because the we that is assembled here is, of course, also a very sort of elitist group of people. I mean, honestly, we haven't managed to get the world population in equal shares assembled to this event. So then who will speak for the Yanomami except for you and other anthropologists who who bring them to our forum? And that I find is really, really a big challenge, because then it's like this, hand me down, it's the handed down, it's the reports we get. And I want to ask Bron how we go about this to give it an adequate, a visible place in the curriculum.
I think it's a real challenge, and obviously we are where we are. You know, we have this fantastic assembly of people, which I'm so excited I'm going to spend the rest of this week with. We'll do the best we can, and then we'll learn for the future. But I think it's important that, we do try to think imaginatively about initiatives that can genuinely, decenter the Anthropocene discourse, just decamp out, decamp to the south, basically, for a few years, and sort of, okay, what does it look like from somewhere else? I think one thing that I was trying to get across, I suppose, in my talk was that even when we start attending to non-Western voices, there are still many, many holes we can fall into and not really be confronted by the full challenge of what we're seeing and what we're hearing. You know, obviously, anthropology as a discourse itself has had to kind of unlearn all the mistakes it made in the 19th century, but in a way that they're just a specific example of the white mythology that Derrida talks about, and it's tricky. It's tricky.
And then the governance. Not to forget the governance issue.
We're going to run out of time in 10 minutes, so let me collect several different comments or questions all at once, and then we'll give the panel a chance to respond. So I have several people up here who had their hands up. This person here first, Helmut Trischler, and then go ahead. And we'll...
Thanks. I'm Alexandra Toland from the TU Berlin Department of Soil Protection. Parallel to this idea of deep time is also the long now, so thinking in terms of seven generations. And I was thinking during Bron's talk about my three-year-old daughter, who believes in dinosaurs. She thinks they exist now. She also can communicate with foxes in kind of a proto-shamanistic sense. I'm wondering about how to include this unorganized knowledge of children into this discussion on interdisciplinarities and transdisciplinarity. What role do they have in the discourse on valuing nature and knowledge transfer? Thanks.
Okay, next, Helmut.
Thank you, Helmut Trischler from Munich. I'd like to come back to the issue of time, because I think it's so crucial for our understanding of the Anthropocene. And it was fascinating to see such a broad consensus amongst our panelists about the necessity to break away from our traditional linear understanding of history to a more cyclical understanding. Now, that's an easy claim to make, and I very much subscribe to it, but it's so different to implement it. And why is it so difficult? I mean, it's so heavily built into our modern understanding of modernity. I mean, remind us to the beautiful lecture we've got when we opened up the Anthropocene project here in the room by Daniel Rosenberg, his wonderful cartography of time, where he showed us that this linearity, this is part of our modern understanding. So my question to you is how to do so? How can we really come to a more cyclical understanding? What does it mean in for our practice of knowledge production? Do we have to order it very differently, or how can we overcome the linearity?
Big challenge.
So I'm Maria Paula Diogo from the Center of the InterUniversity Center of Lisbon. I'm an historian of technology, and I would like to know how do you think to integrate, for instance, the question of transhumanism concerning the Anthropocene campus. As Manfred mentioned, that the biodiversity that we will have to face in the future may be completely different from the one we are used to. As we can, in fact, change our human species inside, and how that will have consequences concerning our idea of politics, the question of democracy, the question of how to the who and how we manage resources. So I would like not to join the question of transhumanism in the question of climate and the managing of resources.
Great. And one last one, and then we'll answer everything in 5 minutes.
And everybody will answer it. Mm-hmm.
It, but it's just very simple and very small. It has to do with thinking about all these group of people who is here, all of us, and who is actually able to be the Yanomami here. I mean, who can take seriously the relationship with time that shaman has? Who is not representing it here or in reference to it or anthropologically bringing it, but who here looks at himself or herself and knows that knowledge is operative, experiential in them? Because I think that's a question we go around all the time. How perhaps there are here among us Yanomamis. Perhaps I am one of them. Perhaps I've leaped into that in some way or others have. But can we really talk from there is the vertigo that I feel all the time in this kind of situations here? Can we really speak from that place where time is out of joint, where interdimensionality, multidimensionality is playing, where code, not the one of the computer, but the shamanic code is a science and not a kind of superstitious speculation or hallucination? Are there portals to other dimensions that are to be brought in without laughter? No. Because we are talking about other kinds of knowledges, and there is a filter to a lot of this other vocabulary that would come from the voice of a shaman. It would be sung as well. There would be body here. We're very much in the discursive. There's a lot of things that we're bringing into this conversation that have huge implications about how we would be operating here if that other knowledge were really in the room.
Beautiful question. Let me just say, so we have four questions. Who can be the Yanomami here? Children's knowledge, cyclical time, and transhumanism. And in a lot of ways, all of these are about various other forms of knowledge and belief. Jürgen.
I first would dispute the introductory remark that the question about the Yanomami is a small and simple thing, as you said by way of introduction. It's a big question that you are asking. My simple answer would be science shouldn't be posited somewhere, on a podest saying this is Western rationality. It's not. Science has been and is global, is having many resources that it actually shares with shamanism, including some of the personal experiences of scientists, but also of scientists of the past. So science shouldn't be, you know, considered as this purified and clear things, which doesn't mean to put it down, to debunk it in a way, but it's a certain historically specific kind of knowledge. And when Manfred was talking about the inner fish, well, that's a way to get into not only into deep time, but into some of my internal deep issues of my body, understanding it. Perhaps it looks very different from the shamanic way, but maybe it also has commonalities with the shamanic way. Now to the children's knowledge. I think I would recommend you, as you are from Berlin, to go to the Comenius Garden, which is a very special place in Berlin, where children do joint research with scientists. Believe it or not, it's not about science popularization, it's about concepts, children's concepts of science, and scientists aware that their own concepts are in flux. It's an experiment. We have, as an institute, participated, and it's a wonderful experience. So children's knowledge can be taken seriously, and not just in a rhetorical way, in a practical way. About the cyclicity of time, I think we have another time issue here, very lived, practical time issue, which is the urgency issue that was brought up. And the urgency issue, however, has to be contrasted, I believe, with the temporality of our own actions. If you think of the work of sociologists like Norbert Elias and so, who have brought out how much of our societal organization is shaped and crystallizes around the temporality issues. So I think what we have to match is also this sense of urgency with the temporality of our own actions. And maybe we should just relax from time to time and organize our own temporality in a way as to leave more space for this kind of reflection. It's an insufficient answer, I realize. Transhumanism. I think it addresses the problem of knowledge that we have tried to put in the center. We, as a human species, and this goes back to the other question about individual versus shared knowledge, we as a species have developed a shared knowledge that puts us into the responsibility even for our own biological identity. And it's very hard to escape that responsibility. You can try to shy away from it. But I think the option that the Anthropocene reflection suggests us is to embrace it.
Johan.
Actually, I tried to put together the children with the shaman and somehow the cyclic dimension of our perception of time. Although I have a specific, very sympathetic look at the children, kids dimension. Beyond these, giving the chance to the children to touch science as it's made by several of us, I would maintain the idea, old-fashioned idea, that the best thing you can do to them, to open them up to imagination, is to put off the lights and tell them a story before they go to bed. I mean, if you can do that for 2-3 years in a row, that, I think, it pays back. Now, children and shaman, I think, is also the question of how we move. I mean, what's in between knowledge and action, knowledge and decision? Most of the time, and we've seen that with the Berlin case, most of the time there is no direct link between knowledge and action. What's in between? There are different things in between, but whatever those things are, they have to go apparently through a filter, through a channel, that's believing. You may know, but you do not do it because you don't believe it. So, where is the shaman? Where is the... that's the Neolithic part of us. That's the which comes up systematically when we have to move to action or decision. So, some of the decisions can be taken because there is belief in the authority of someone that has this capacity to create through imagination a kind of shift. But one thing that I think we all have learned at school, although it's not sold as such, is that we moved from knowledge to action through dramatic events. And I think World War II is a perfect point in case, because if you take Roosevelt, and I finish there, if you've seen what Roosevelt has put on the table after the Second World War, that tells us there is a lot of room to move to action and decision just by having experienced dramatic change of your routine way of living, doing, acting, and knowing.
Brian.
Yeah, I wanted to answer all four, but I haven't got time. Well, firstly, I think the sort of linearity of modern Western time can be overplayed, I think. And I'm tempted, I'll use this term that Ernesto Laclau uses, which is suturing, as in sort of stitching up, you know, that the sort of body of Western time is constantly breaking apart. It's in its unity and has to be stitched back together into this sort of, you know, official meta-narrative, if you like, of linearity and progress and so on. Because I think, you know, if you look at the real, as it were, lived experience of time, it's much more complex, even in Western societies. You know, there are moments that seem to participate in other moments. You know, even, you know, coming back to my house in Poland, you know, every time I put the key in the door, the first time that year, it's the same moment, you know, as I've done it before in some sense. You know, when people describe, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, when personal time meshes with historical time, you know, there are weird things happening with time all the time. And that these are all part of being even a Western individual. So I think underneath the sort of official linearity, there's a lot more complex times. And it's not just about cyclicity, it's also about, you know, different times meshing and time facing backward facing time, forward facing time, and those kind of time, you know, feeling intense and important and dull and uninteresting. There's so many different forms of time. On the shamans, a shaman has to be bodily present almost by definition. If you look at the kind of words, if you did a kind of a word, it's one of your word, you know, semantic. Thing that Manfred talks about of Kopenhauer's book. There's lots of language about light and transparency and mirrors and shining and brilliance and things. This is about the kind of pre-differentiated world where spirits and animals and humans are all the same. But there's also a hell of a lot of bones. I was Googling for searching for bones because I was trying to find a passage. Now, oh my God, every page has at least three mentions of bones of their dead being incinerated, but bones being broken, everything. It's very, very bodily. And in a way, when shamans communicate, they communicate in the architectural sense, like rooms communicate. It's a bodily, physical connection. So I think you're right that shamans have to be physically present, there's something interesting to think about that.
Okay. We are about to engage in a unit of cyclical time, lunch. So, yes. Also a universal form of human experience, sharing meals.
Exactly. And animal experience, too.
And animal experience. And maybe some bones for some of us.
Thanks, everyone. And a lot gets lost, of course.